WVUR Boston and NPR. I'm Lise Doucette. This is The Connection. Almost 2 years ago, America fought a war in Afghanistan to bring down the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda network. But it was more than that.
I make this promise to all the victims of that regime. The Taliban's days of harboring terrorists and dealing in heroin and brutalizing women are drawing to a close. And when that regime is gone, the people of Afghanistan will say with the rest of the world, good riddance.
The world made a pledge. We are with you, Afghanistan, for the long haul. But now the Taliban are growing in strength. Hardly a day goes by when there isn't a clash, an attack on government workers, including clerics or international aid workers. More and more Afghans are asking, where is the security and the aid we were promised? And now the Bush administration seems to be listening. There are plans to triple aid for Afghanistan, and NATO troops take over peacekeeping duties in Kabul this month. Connection listeners, what does the U.S. owe the people of Afghanistan? Has America forgotten the lessons of September 11th, that security in Afghanistan is linked to security at home? Or with Al-Qaeda still wreaking havoc in Africa and Asia, should the U.S. be directing its attention elsewhere? How will the U.S. and the international community know when it's succeeded in Afghanistan? Will it be when the warlords are gone, or when Afghans have food on their tables? Our number, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Well, let's first get an idea of what is happening on the ground in Afghanistan. We'll go to the Afghan capital, Kabul, to join my colleague, Ian McWilliam of the BBC. He's been covering Afghanistan for nearly two decades. Ian, welcome to the programme.
Hello, Lise, yes.
Hello. You just came back to Afghanistan recently. What's it like there now?
Well, I have to say, each time I come back in over the past year, it seems to be a bit more upbeat. The mood is better, despite these clouds in the background of the problems of the warlords, the security problems out in the countryside. In Kabul, life does seem to be improving bit by bit. It's much busier. Shops are opening. The government offices are getting a bit more organized. As you were saying earlier, there are now five internet cafes in the city. The last time I came, I think there's only one. New restaurants are opening, and people are beginning to have a feeling that perhaps life is moving towards normality. In the background of that, though, there are these security problems, and certainly outside of Kabul, life is still very unstable. You have a lot of incidents where local commanders are causing problems. There is infighting, in particular in the north and in the south around Kandahar, occasionally, where there seems to be a resurgent movement of the Taliban. So those shadows are in the background. Although, overall, life does seem to be improving bit by bit.
But where is it improving, Ian? We've heard Afghans so many times saying, my own life has not improved, the aid money doesn't seem to be going in the right places. Can you see concrete improvements?
Yes. I mean, I would say the educated people here are starting to find some jobs. If you go, the businesses are getting better. If you go into the old city, which a year ago was a completely ravaged mess, shops are being rebuilt. There are new buildings going up. As I said, there are signs that life is improving for a middle class. People have returned to the country. Something like 2 million refugees returned last year. A smaller number are returning this year because of the difficulties of finding work. As I said, it is a very gradual improvement, very gradual, with these background problems of long-term security. In next week, NATO is going to take over charge of the International Security Force, which is here in the capital, and it's hoped that will provide a more long-term, concrete security here in the capital. And possibly, if the capital stays secure, then it is hoped that the Kabul government will be able to extend its influence gradually into the other cities.
But any hints, Ian, that possibly NATO peacekeepers could move out of Kabul? Because everyone you talk to, whether it's the United Nations or the aid workers or Afghans, they say unless security improves outside of Kabul, nothing can happen, not even the elections are set for next year.
Yes, well, certainly the International Security Force has not moved outside of the capital. There's no definite indications that they will. The main problem, it'd be a very expensive enterprise, and the big question is who would pay for the extension of these peacekeepers throughout the country. That's always held in the background. I don't think there's a realistic possibility that it's going to happen soon. The international force, the coalition and American forces who are based here, They are hoping that they can extend some sort of security through what they're calling provincial reconstruction teams. Now, these are groups of military personnel who are going out to some of the remoter towns where they work together to provide some sort of security for the reconstruction plans of the aid organizations. Now, there has been criticism of these teams because they blur the line between the aid reconstruction projects and between the military. But from the American side, it seems that they're hoping that this will provide some sort of security focus outside the capital.
And Ian, how worried are they in Kabul about these reports of the Taliban gaining strength in their old strongholds of southern Afghanistan?
Well, I think that is a serious concern. President Hamid Karzai, just a couple of days ago, he said he didn't think it was a serious problem. But reports from Kandahar do speak of considerable unease there. In the past couple of months, two Muslim clerics, important Muslim clerics from the central council there, have been murdered by presumed Taliban supporters, and another was severely wounded when a bomb was set off in a mosque. And there's quite a severe backlash among these Taliban supporters against clerics who are supporting the central government, and that's the key problem. There is this opposition to the government in Kabul among the tribal border areas next to Pakistan, and that seems to be crystallizing in this resurgence of the Taliban. So that's a serious problem that the government is going to have to look at.
Well, Ian, thank you so much for giving us that update on how it looks in Kabul and beyond as you came back to the capital a few days ago. And thank you very much for joining us here on The Connection. Well, now let's welcome two people, two Afghans who think about their country from different perspectives, not to mention places on the map. Omar Zakiwal is a senior advisor to the Afghan government's Ministry of Rural Reconstruction and Development. He's in the BBC's studio in Kabul. Welcome, Omar.
Hello, Neith.
Nice to talk to you. We also have Khalid Husseini, who lives in California. He's the author of an acclaimed new novel, The Kite Runner, set in Afghanistan. Thanks so much, Khalid, for joining us. And I have to say that I'm reading your book, and it's a very, very beautiful and evocative story about Afghanistan.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Good. Now, Khalid, when you returned back to your country, you left before all of this upheaval a few decades ago. But when you went back to Afghanistan earlier this year, you wrote an editorial in which you asked the question, is Afghanistan dying again? What's your answer?
My answer is I hope not. When I went back to Afghanistan, I saw much of what Ian just described, internet cafes going up and fancy restaurants being built and really a bustling city. But I really found two cities. That particular city worked very well, I thought, for the Afghan emigres and those who'd come back from exile, as well as the various foreign workers. But I thought for the average Afghan who'd come back maybe from refugee camps in Pakistan and Iran, I found that those people came back to find more hunger and poverty and a lack of jobs. And I found a whole lot of people in Kabul on the street talking to me about a sort of sense of disillusionment with the reconstruction process and promises that were made that not necessarily have materialized.
But is the situation that desperate that you met people who actually didn't have enough to eat? There was no food on the table.
Well, I mean, at the risk of sounding like a muckraker, I'll say that I met various people on the street who explained to me fairly desperate situations. I met a policeman who told me that he had to feed 8 kids, and he'd borrowed from just about every relative he could think of, and he hadn't been paid in months. And he told me he knew somebody who became so desperate that he fed rat poison to his children and to himself out of an act of desperation. So I think that those may be extreme examples, but I think the inability to provide for one's family and frustration at low and infrequent pay are very common complaints in Kabul.
And you also told a story about when you went to a hospital and you yourself tried to do your own little aid by finding, what was it, an ordinary plastic catheter to save the life of a 15-year-old boy?
Well, I don't want to take any credit for anything. When there was a boy who was brought in by his father from outside the city, and he was gradually going blind because of brain tumors that had caused water collection in his brain and were compressing the optic nerves. And what he really needed was something called a VP shunt, which is a very simple plastic catheter, which unfortunately it turned out was not to be found anywhere in the city. And the lady who worked for the NGO and I drove around, and she finally bought it basically off the black market from this physician in an alley for something like 8 times the price that it was really worth to provide this equipment to this child. And I mean, this is a very simple piece of equipment that any neurosurgery department would typically have.
And is this the story of Afghanistan? Let's bring in Omar Zakiwal, who has to look at it from a different perspective, from inside a government minister. Omar, I remember we met in Kabul last year when you've come back from Canada, and you were really critical of some of the moves underway to try to get the government, to get the country back on track. How do you feel now? What does it look like where you're sitting?
Well, I probably think differently now that I'm living in Afghanistan. One has to look into the situation in Afghanistan in relative terms, not in absolute terms. One has to look at the situation now as opposed to it was 6 months ago, a year ago, 2 years ago. And if the situation now overall is better than 6 months ago, a year ago, and 2 years ago, then there's room for optimism. And the situation certainly, bit by bit, is improving. What we see now is much better than overall than 6 months ago and a year ago, and therefore that's how I look into it.
Well, let's just look at, for example, one of the objectives that was said by the international aid community was that they wanted to empower the Afghan government. When I was there a few months ago, you'd go into some ministries and there was absolutely nothing, no staff, no computers, hardly even any chairs. And then in other ministries, and I think the one you work with, there was a certain buzz, there was advisors like yourself, there was computers, that people were getting back to work. Do you have a sense that the means needed for the government to get on its feet are actually improving?
It depends on the ministries. The ministries, they do show their commitment for change and for reform have been awarded. And I think that is, in my opinion, the way to go. There are ministries that are resistant to change and to reform and therefore have attracted little assistance as opposed to those who have shown, like just you said, I mean, our ministry, it has shown that it's committed to reform, it is committed to change, it's open to suggestions, and therefore we have little problem attracting resources. But there are other ministries who probably are not willing to change, and therefore they have difficulties. So the problem is not the international community sort of not delivering assistance to these ministries, but probably there is something there as well, but it has a lot to do with the ministries themselves.
Yes, and that's what we want to find out, whether the aid is being delivered to the ministries and whether the aid is the right kind of aid. A second chance for Afghanistan. What will it take to bring security and development? We'd also like to hear from you. 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Lise Doucette. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Doucette, this is The Connection. Growing threats to Afghanistan. Are the Taliban slowly gaining strength less than 2 years after they were toppled? We hear from Afghans about their hopes and disappointments. There are new pledges from Washington and NATO forces. What should the priorities be? We'd like to hear from you. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Well, we're getting lots of calls from people who do want to talk to us. Habu is on the line from Madison in Wisconsin. Habu, what do you want to say about the situation in Afghanistan?
Good morning to you.
Good morning. It's
so nice to have you on this side of the pond. I listen to your talking point, and it's good to bring your Beeb type of analysis to the United States.
Well, it's a good place to meet on The Connection. Habu, what would you like to say?
I'm not speaking for the Afghani people. I'm not that myself. But, you know, it seems that the United States policy has been so miserly when it comes to, from what I read and hear, they're crying for money out there, not money to be siphoned off by for corruption, but for building infrastructure or having projects going. But what we have done instead, it seems to me like, is keep those warlords as our proxies to maintain some kind of peace in the interior, and it's only around Kabul that there is some semblance of peace. So to me, this is a very false sense of what is going on, and or false peace. And I find it hilarious that somebody mentions about internet cafes when people can't even get a basic kind of education.
So what do you think should be done? We have these reports that the Bush administration is considering a huge aid package for Afghanistan over the next year. Do you think this will go some way to meeting the problems you talk about?
You know, I'm not one of those high-priced, high-paid NGOs, but it would seem to me that, you know, people, they want to get going and there's so much of inertia in the system that they just can't get started because of warring factions, etc. It seems like once they get peace and once there isn't this kind of a warlord system in place there, it will just be the force of people being able to work and getting on with their lives will be enough to get the system going. But I don't know how to figure that out. But I still think that what we're doing is not the right thing.
Well, Habu, thank you very much for calling us with your concern. You're right. Internet cafes probably aren't so important in the scheme of things. But I think in Kabul, it does matter, certainly to educated Afghans who like to feel that their country is no longer cut off from the rest of the world, to perhaps a symbol. Well, Habu, like many of our callers and, in fact, our guests were talking about the problems outside of Kabul, particularly in southern Afghanistan, where there are almost daily reports of the Taliban forces regrouping and carrying out attacks. Well, here in The Connection, we like to go to the source of the story. So now we're going to go to Kandahar to join Sarah Chase. She's the director of the NGO Afghans for Civil Society. She's speaking to us on a satellite phone. Sarah, welcome to The Connection.
Well, thank you so much, and it's a pleasure. I'll echo the caller to meet you this way, Liz.
Well, there in your former NPR colleague. Sarah, tell us, what's it like to live in Kandahar? All we hear are very stories of how dangerous it is.
Let me say a couple of things. I love living in Kandahar. I absolutely adore it here. It's a very interesting place. It's very interesting. But what I would say is to forcefully reiterate the difference that was touched upon by some of the people who've already spoken between Kabul and the provinces. It was astonishing to me to hear our colleague Ian saying that things are getting better at all. Because in Kandahar, it is very manifestly and clearly getting much worse. And this is a place where I've lived for the past almost 2 years. And I've always been criticized for not being sufficiently security conscious and things like that. For the first time in the last 2 weeks, I feel like there's a possibility of losing this province,
So tell us where it's going wrong, Sarah. Give us an example of what's getting worse.
All right. Let me see if I can, there's a kind of scheme, and let me see if I can explain it clearly enough. Our caller just mentioned warlords, and to me, the grasp of warlords upon the important provinces of Afghanistan is the single most serious problem that this country is facing. And the particular governor of this province, is committing daily depredations against the citizens of the province. He's treating the province as his personal property, and his private militia is simply on a rampage, or rampage is, let's say, living off the land, meaning they regularly harass and shake down taxi and truck drivers. They enter people's homes at night on pretext of searching for the Taliban and rob these homes. They abduct people. They torture people. They rape people. And the people of Kandahar province are being driven to the limit by this kind of behavior. The problem is that this governor is seen as being inextricably linked to the U.S. presence here. I took a taxi from the Pakistani border to Kandahar recently, and the taxi driver was echoing what I've heard time and time again when he said, if the Americans weren't here, these people wouldn't last 5 minutes. We would have them out.
But let's clarify, Carrie, just a minute, Carrie. We talk about these warlords. Let's, for our listeners, the warlords can be powerful commanders that hold all the guns and the people under arms in the provinces. But as you mentioned, here you have a governor who's a warlord. So in effect, he is part of President Hamid Karzai's team, he's terrorizing the population.
Correct. That's correct. And that is what's so terribly confusing for the people of, again, I'll just speak from the province that I know well, is Kandahar. For the people of Kandahar, what's terribly confusing to them is they are faced with two alternatives. One is what they see to be an alliance between the warlords, the Americans, and the central government. And the other is the Taliban. So it's true that there is, I would say if you took a poll in Kandahar province, 50% of the people would wish for a return of the Taliban, not for ideological reasons, not because they're Muslim, they're Islamist extremists, but because they're desperate for law and order. They're desperate for predictable oppression. For the human spirit, arbitrary, unpredictable oppression is almost unbearable.
Well, tell us about how that translates into daily life for Afghans who live in Kandahar. For example, do women feel they can go out on the streets now? Can children go to school? Can you walk about safely? What does it mean to daily life?
It's such a complicated picture, Lise. Women do go out. Children are going to school. Girls are going to school. But we did a kind of thumbnail survey. We do a lot of work with women, and we did a thumbnail survey of families that we knew very well and found that 50% of them are unwilling to send their children to school. Girls to school. That's because they were afraid of what people would say, mostly. But here's the problem, is that this provincial administration, which is linked to the central government and linked to the Americans, is known to be extremely profligate and debased in its behavior. For example, the governor is a known drunk in an Islamic society, which is very difficult. So, for example, the education director takes girls out of school to dance in front of visiting dignitaries. And this has families up in arms.
Well, indeed. Well, I'm not surprised. Now, Sarah, let's see that you've identified some. Now we're really going into the area of Islamic modesty and decency and things which might upset a lot of Afghans. I want to bring in Omar Zakiwal, who's in Kabul and is working with the government, although he's a critical observer as well. Omar, this is an incredibly complicated problem, as Sarah says, the hold of the warlords, because in effect they work with the government and they work against the government, and you seem to need them in some ways to keep some kind of security in the provinces, but they seem to be working against some of the biggest goals that you're trying to achieve. I mean, can you move against these people? Can you stop these abuses?
I agree with your guest that these warlords or these regional power holders are there because of the American support. And it probably made sense at the time when the Americans came to fight against Taliban and Al-Qaeda to make them allies.
And in the fight against Al-Qaeda, yes.
Al-Qaeda, in the hope of the Afghan people was that this was not a permanent alliance, that this was a temporary one. And after that, as the Afghan people were promised, this legitimate people who respected human rights, people, professional people would be brought into Afghanistan, and they would be the one who would be running the government affairs of the country. Unfortunately, that did not happen. But lately, we do see that the Americans probably do see that as a mistake. They went into sort of a longer term alliance rather than a shorter term with these people. We do observe some pressure from not only from Americans but from other international community forces, particularly the European community. A change has to come, not only in provinces, but in Kabul as well. And I must add this, the problems that we see in Kandahar or in Western Afghanistan or Eastern or Northern Afghanistan are partly the symptoms of a weak central government. And I think before you go to Kandahar, there are things that need to be corrected in Kabul as well.
So let's be clear on this. If there is to be a strong central government, Hamid Karzai, the president, who doesn't have very much of an army himself, needs the American and other forces to help back him up. But they have another priority, which is to continue to fight against the remnants of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. So in effect, we're pursuing two contradictory objectives at the same time.
Let's put it this way. You see, the warlords that we have in provinces, they're American allies for one reason alone, and that's to fight against terrorism and Al-Qaeda. And they, and these people are rational. They know very well that this is the reason why they're there for. And if this reason goes away, they probably will not be allies. And for that reason, they will make sure that their reason remains in Afghanistan. So not only they will be involved in the things that, because your guest from Kandahar described that they're involved in, they probably will also be in favor of the presence of terrorism of Al-Qaeda and of Taliban in Afghanistan, because that would remain the reason for the alliance with the Americans.
Oh, dear.
Yes.
Well, let's just bring in Sarah Chase again, who's still on the line from Kandahar, to respond to that.
Sorry, I just wanted to emphatically agree with that. Emphatically agree. It is absolutely clear in Kandahar that that these so-called U.S. allies are in fact allowing the extremist elements back in from Pakistan. It's like a man flying two kites. They're flying the American kite and the extremist kite at the same time, and just tweaking the strings enough of each side to keep both in the air.
Well, kites are something that Afghan children and Afghan grown-ups understand well, and I'm glad we're agreeing on what the problem is. The question is, what can be done? Sarah Chase, thank you very much for joining us from Canada, and do take care. Let's take our call. Let's see what the Connection listeners think about these problems in Afghanistan and how to solve them. Imran is calling us from Ashland, Massachusetts. Imran, what would you like to say?
Well, I was hoping that maybe your speakers could kind of comment on a possible solution that kind of addresses the long-term needs of Afghanistan. And that is that, my understanding has always been that the spread of Islam into Central Asia has always been kind of through the Sufis. And so if money is to be put into Afghanistan from a long-term development standpoint for purposes of counteracting extremism, why not, I guess, maybe have the U.S. and like-minded allies, including those in the Muslim world, start financing, let's say, Sufi-style madrasas? I think madrasas are pretty much accepted as the culturally accepted norm of education. And
would it necessarily have to be Sufi? It could be any form of moderate progressive Islam, in the sense that what Afghans themselves would want.
Exactly. I mean, by Sufi, I think I'm using it more in a generic form of a moderate, tolerant form of Islam. I myself am a Muslim. I've been born and raised here, but my understanding of Islam has always been, you know, one of tolerance and not towards the Taliban style or the Wahhabi style, which I guess people tend to glom onto as the extremist form. But why not put money into affecting a long-term change in the mindset of especially the young, so that you start to eliminate the ideology of extremism?
Well, let's bring in Khalid Husseini, who, Khalid, if I can safely say, a man who's perhaps got one foot in the West and one foot in your own country of Afghanistan. How do you respond to Imran's suggestion?
Well, I would say that I would probably meet with great resistance in various parts. Afghanistan has always been a deeply religious country, but there are certainly factions in Afghanistan who would simply not tolerate this sort of liberal interpretation of Islam. In various parts of the country, as Sarah Chase just pointed out, people are reluctant to even let their women out of the house, to let them go to school, become educated.
Is that tradition?
No, that's more tradition, or the interpretation of Islam by those traditions. Some of the local governors, including the ones in Kandahar and some of the ones, for example, the one in Herat, are also deeply conservative people religiously, and they will simply not, in my opinion, tolerate this kind of liberal education.
But would you see it as a process, though, if, for example, people, of course, are allowed to practice their religion in Afghanistan? Islam is certainly not under threat there. But if ideas such as educating girls and tolerance can be introduced, you think this would be antithetical to Afghans? Certainly President Hamid Karzai talks about making this a tolerant, open, broad-minded Islam.
Sure. I mean, theoretically, it's a terrific idea. I question its viability as a pragmatic solution.
Well, this is a question that will indeed come up next month when there's a lawyer jirga to decide on a new constitution for Afghanistan. It remains a sensitive topic post-Taliban. Omar Zakiwal, what would you like to say on this point?
Well, you see, there are two different things. I mean, conservatism in extremism. Afghans, sure, they are conservative. They are traditionalists, but they do not overwhelmingly subscribe to extremism. Right now, I do sort of, being part of the Ministry of Rural Rehabilitation and Development, I do travel to rural areas a lot. And these are areas where people follow, they're religious in their very traditional, but at the same time, they abhor the type of extreme Islam that this both the Taliban brought upon them in the ones that is subscribed by the Mujahideen, the extreme Mujahideen leaders. So I don't think one should get into that. I mean, Afghanistan. Our Afghans, overwhelmingly, although they are conservative, but religiously they are moderate. And therefore, the problem here is not religion or resistance to this or that type of religion. The problem right now is warlordism. The problem is security. The problem is the issue of reconstruction. And that's where we should put our focus on.
Many problems, and let's hope there are many solutions. A reminder to our listeners, you're listening to The Connection. I'm Lise Doucette, and we'd like you to keep your calls coming in. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Today, we're talking about a second chance for Afghanistan. What will it take to bring about security and development nearly 2 years after the Taliban was toppled? What does the United States owe the people of that country? Stay tuned. Set. This is The Connection. Today we're talking about growing threats to Afghanistan. We've been hearing about how the Taliban are slowly gaining strength, how the warlords are still in power in many provinces outside of Kabul. And we're also asking, what will it take to get it right? What does the international community, and in particular the United States, owe Afghanistan, and is security here linked to security far away in that country? Well, let's take a caller on the line from Natick in Massachusetts. Lakshmi joins us. Lakshmi, what point would you like to make on these issues?
I just want to say, I lived in Afghanistan many years ago. I actually left after the Russians came in.
You're Afghan?
No, I'm Indian.
Right.
And what I'm seeing right now is that the world is so caught up in this Taliban thing, and I don't think that's fair. And again, pushing our westernized ideology of what traditions or Islamism Afghanistan should have, I don't think is right. Afghanistan was always a conservative country, but always very far ahead of its time in certain ways. And I think what we need to concentrate is get away from this fear of Afghanistan turning into a Taliban society, but spend more time and energy into getting aid out to the rural areas, helping the poor. I'm seeing a disconnect between the educated upper class and those and the have-nots. And I think that could lead to long-term issues if not addressed right now.
But do you feel it's important that aid does keep going to Afghanistan, to those areas that you mentioned? There is still, if you like, a responsibility to keep giving attention to that country.
Oh, absolutely. I think that country is very important, not only in that area, but the world owes that country a lot. The world let that country down a long time ago. political games were played by superpowers, which is why Afghanistan is where it is. When I lived there, it was a beautiful place. Security was never an issue. Afghans were the most hospitable people you could ever know. It was an amazing country. Breaks my heart that it is the way it is now.
Well, let's bring in Khalid Husseini, who's still on the line from California. Khalid Husseini, do you think there is a responsibility that the United States owes and the rest of the world owes something to your country?
Well, personally, I do believe that. I want to address what the caller said also about the world concern about the Taliban. The concern of the world about the Taliban is not based on religious ideology. It's based on the security threat that they pose to Afghanistan and the direct negative impact that those rogue forces have on the rebuilding process in Afghanistan. So that's the concern about the Taliban. But do I think the world owes, and particularly the U.S. owes Afghanistan? I want to say yes to that for three reasons. Number one, I think the U.S. has an invested interest in what happens in Afghanistan within the borders of Afghanistan. We all saw the consequence of letting Afghanistan go and letting it become a breeding ground for extremist factions. Number two, I think this sort of hubristic attitude of bomb them and leave them doesn't serve the American image very well in the international arena. And number three, from a personal standpoint, from a moral standpoint, I think the U.S. does owe the Afghan people. 1 million Afghans were killed in the Soviet war. And although there were many reasons for the Soviet collapse, certainly the devastating defeat in Afghanistan played a major role.
And do you think there's still a risk, Khalid? Of course, it is said now that it was the abandonment of Afghanistan after the Soviet troops left that led, sadly, to the attacks of September the 11th. But could that ever happen again, do you believe, if the international community ignores Afghanistan or doesn't get it right?
Well, I define ignoring and forgetting Afghanistan as not making a thoroughly strong commitment to rebuilding Afghanistan. And I believe the rebuilding of Afghanistan, the commitment to rebuilding that country, cannot occur without a commitment to security and peace in that country. You need security for reconstruction, and you need reconstruction for security. But first and foremost, peace has to come, stability has to come. And when the U.S. and the international community limit the peacekeeping forces to Kabul and ally themselves with folks like the warlords who further destabilize the situation, I really question the long-term goals for that country.
Well, let's find out if our listeners on The Connection agree with you. Karen is on the line from Winchester, Massachusetts. Karen, what's your point?
Yes, hi, Liz. First of all, thank you so much for having a program on Afghanistan. I feel like most of the American public has completely forgotten about it, and it's a total shame. I just got back from spending a year there. I was working as one of those overpaid NGO people that everyone keeps talking about, and I just wanted to, explain how the pace of reconstruction was proceeding. We, in my program and a lot of other programs, were encouraged to do these quick impact projects, so something that could be built quickly. You know, a school, a bridge, an irrigation project, so that the people could see progress. But there was very little large-scale infrastructure reconstruction going on or any kind of jobs program, job creation program. We were actually told, my program was funded by USAID, and we were told that we could not touch anything that was a state-owned enterprise. Well, seeing as the last functioning government in Afghanistan was a communist government, most of the enterprises state-owned. So, we weren't able to fix, for example, you know, part of a textile factory and put thousands of people back to work. And I know that Amnesty International has released a report saying that that the conditions aren't secure enough to come back for refugees and IDPs to return, and that there aren't any jobs anyway. So we really need to be thinking about the long-term impact of not creating jobs, not trying to fix enterprises, state-owned enterprises, or try and fix their manufacturing of any sort.
But in any small way, Karen, did you feel that those quick impact projects you talk about, the school, the house, that it made a difference in some small way?
Sure, it makes a difference to those people, you know, whose girls haven't been able to go to school for the last 6 years and they now have a new school building. But if you, you know, that's just in that village. You go to the village next door and they haven't seen any progress.
Well, let's bring in Omar Zakiwal, Omar, because this criticism has been made before that it was the wrong, it wasn't just the quantity of aid, it was the wrong kind of aid. Do you agree with Karen, and do you think the situation is now changing?
Well, first, it would be unfair that nothing has happened or nothing, no reconstruction work has taken place in Afghanistan.
But not the big ones. Thing that, there isn't much bigger.
Well, Yes, true. No big reconstruction projects have been undertaken, and that is what the international community, in the media, in the people in Afghanistan, to a large extent as well, judge the reconstruction work by. And certainly, the attitude toward a big reconstruction project such as highways is changing. The commitment of the U.S. to build the Kabul-Kandahar highway by the end of the year is certainly a positive change in the attitude of the Americans, and there are certainly other large projects such as the highway, Jalalabad-Kabul highway, Kabul-Mazar highway, and there are so many other highways that are now seriously under consideration for an immediate start. But besides that, like right now in our ministry, there are about 400 small projects that are either under in progress or been completed, and there is another very big program in our ministry, the National Solidarity Program. It's about $600 million worth or $700 million worth of projects that would be completed within the next 3 years, and we just started it, and we'll be reaching out to about 7,000 villages in this area, and it will have impact on about 5 million people. So certainly a lot is happening in smaller scales, and if you sum it up, it's not small scale, it's big scale, but obviously many people judge the reconstruction work in Afghanistan, and to a certain extent fairly to on these bigger projects, but we will see something happening to those as well.
So something is being done, but I think all our callers agree that it's not enough. Let me bring back in Karen. Karen, it must seem overwhelming sometimes, because it's not just the Taliban rule that you're trying to recover from. It's a quarter century of war in Afghanistan. When do you think that the international community and American aid would ever reach the point where they say, right, we've done our job, we've brought the country back up to where it should be, that we're comfortable with?
Well, considering that, you know, I think almost somewhere between 50% and 70% of the money that has been given by the international community so far is still going to relief and is not yet going to reconstruction, I think it's going to be a while before we can say, you know, we've done our job. We need to make sure that villages are safe enough for people to return to, and that they actually have water in their villages, that they have schools for their kids. The government is, you know, is up and running, and I think that's going to be a long-term commitment. You're starting from almost zero after, you know, very little has been in 25 years, and most things have been destroyed. So I think I was very happy to hear about the you know, U.S. government deciding to increase their aid to Afghanistan, and let's see how it goes.
Karen, yes, well, thank you. In fact, what you describe is what many of us would hopefully describe as being a normal life, and that's what Afghans would like to have in their country. Thank you for joining us on the line. We'll take another caller now. John is calling us from Lexington in Kentucky. John, what would you like to say about this debate?
Hi, thanks for having me on. I would just like to say that I think that reconstruction could run into a problem because the United States is taking on more and more of what seems to be a straight nation-building agenda as opposed to just battling terrorism in Afghanistan or Iraq, because as we've seen in Iraq, the focus has shifted from, you know, terrorism and weapons of mass destruction to nation-building and controlling security. And we see the same thing happening in Liberia. And I'm concerned that if the U.S. starts to take on that role internationally, that we could lose focus on Afghanistan. As the previous caller said, a lot of people have forgotten that we're even there.
But now let me clear this. You say that the United States should not get involved in nation building. This was the pledge of George W. Bush. He's even talked about a Marshall Plan for some of these countries, that in order to deal with terrorism and security threats, you actually have to put the country back on its feet. You don't think...
I'm not saying that we shouldn't be involved in nation building. I'm just saying that if we do take on that role in 3 or 4 or even 5 different countries, that the amount of attention we can devote to any of them is diminished.
So do you believe that the U.S., for example, should be tripling its aid to Afghanistan, should be giving it that focus?
Oh, I certainly do, but I think that it should focus on one project at a time and finish what it has to do in one country before it moves on to another. And taking on, you know, three major reconstruction projects at once is not something that our administration seems capable of handling.
Well, let's bring in Omar Zakiwal, because, Omar, that question was asked, of course, before the war in Iraq, whether once the Americans went into Iraq, they would forget Afghanistan. Was that a real fear?
I personally would not fear that, because, Afghanistan is now where Americans probably cannot afford to lose. And that is something that they've expressed publicly, and that's what I believe. I think the commitment of the U.S. here, it's right now the money that has committed is not a large sum. I think it can do a lot better than that. The $1 billion more that they are committing or will commit is a welcoming news, but perhaps more is needed, and I think Americans can afford to put perhaps $1 billion more or $2 billion more into this. And the way to go for Americans is to help Afghans help themselves, and death could not and should not be done through supporting warlords. I think there are legitimate forces within Afghanistan that should be strengthened, and once they are strengthened, I think Afghans are capable of building their nations themselves. They need is some monetary support from outside.
Well, that's agreeing in Khalid Husseini here. Khalid, would you agree with Omar on that?
I would thoroughly agree with that. The amount of the aid is nice, getting the $1 billion package, but the U.S. spends $1 billion a month maintaining its military operation in Afghanistan. A stealth bomber costs $1 million. So in the large picture, although that's a hefty sum of money, it's really not. So I agree with Mr. Zakiwal that more aid is needed to Afghanistan. And I also agree with him that more aid is needed to help Afghans help themselves, and that translates into the money going to where it's needed, that is to the people like Mr. Zakiwal and the folks working in that government. In 2002, I believe only 15% of the money went to the Afghan Transitional Administration, and most of it went to UN-sponsored agencies and NGOs. And that left the government cash-strapped to pay its civil servants and went a long way toward making that government lose some credibility in the eyes of the people.
Well, let's hope they can regain that credibility. Khalid Husseini, thank you very much for joining us on the line from California. Good luck with your writing, Khalid Husseini, author of the new and justifiably acclaimed novel, The Kite Runner. Omar Zakiwal, senior advisor to the Afghan Minister for Rural Reconstruction and Development, was on the line from Kabul. Thank you so much, Omar, for your time. We also heard earlier from Ian McWilliam, the BBC correspondent in Kabul, and from Sarah Chase, Kandahar director of Afghans for Civil Society Connection. Listeners, to continue the conversation, do visit our website, theconnection.org. I'm Lise Doucette, standing in for Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.